Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, an uncomfortable subject that nearly all of us will go through at some point in our life, and that most of us are totally unprepared for. The role of handling the affairs of a loved one who has died. We don't like to talk about death in America, so even the most mundane parts of handling an estate can be a mystery. Attorney Scott Taylor Smith learned the lessons on how to handle the role of the executor the hard way, making mistakes and costing money. And he vowed to make it easier for others at a time when grief can blind our way through the legal and financial steps that are necessary at the time. When Someone Dies, the Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death, is a practical step-by-step primer on the roles and duties of the executor, from making funeral arrangements, dividing assets, to closing a Facebook account. Smith offers lots of advice on the decisions you'll have to make as executor and offers advice on our own affairs to make things easier for those who follow us. Scott Smith is my guest today. Scott Smith, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Your book, When Someone Dies, this is frankly a subject nobody really wants to talk about, but this is a process that most of us are going to go through either with a parent, maybe a grandparent, a sibling, an unmarried sibling or something like this. This is something we go through of being the person responsible for settling the estate of when someone dies. And it's a process which we almost learn through on-the-job experience. And it can be overwhelming.
Oh, it can be. And, you know, with it, we're in a unique position in history where we really have for the first time two generations, you know, dying simultaneously. We've got the parents of the baby boomers and the baby boomers starting as well. So this is a very important current topic. You know, I actually wrote this book. My mother, who was a very healthy 85-year-old, fell down in a parking lot about 3 years ago and had a massive brain injury, and she died 10 days later. And I was her executor, and I'm a former lawyer. I thought I knew enough to get by. And what happened was I started making just a series of horrible, really stupid mistakes because I didn't know. And I'll give you the best example, which was the first one I made within hours of her death. When she got to the mortuary, the wonderful woman at the mortuary asked me how many death certificates I wanted. And I looked at her very confidently and said, well, one will be sufficient. And she took my hand and said, well, I actually think you're going to need more than that. And I said, no, one will be plenty. Well, the truth is you need probably 15 or 20, even 25. Because every financial institution, the 401k administrator, the post office, everybody needs an original copy of the death certificate. And the mortuaries will typically provide them even below cost, whereas if you don't get them from them, you have to go back to the county and wait in line and pay a fortune to get them.
And in fact, your book says 24, if it's a complex estate with lots of money, you're looking more like 36, maybe.
You can, because if you think about it, you look at every credit card, for example, there's a death certificate, every banking account, a safety deposit box, 401k, a pension. If you're going to be transferring real estate, you're going to probably need an original copy of the death certificate to transfer the real estate. It just keeps adding up. And what happened was after my mom died and I started making these mistakes, I went looking for a reference book. I figured there had to be a good book on the topic that gave simple, practical advice. And it turns out that there wasn't one. And so I decided I was going to write it myself.
Well, it is very complete. It seems like to go through about every scenario, whether you have a large estate or whether you have a small estate. I think you actually begin the book as death is approaching. And I think there's a sort of assumption that the person who has the durable power of attorney for health care or, you know, the person who was set up in a living will as the person to make decisions is the person that's going to make decisions after death. And that's not necessarily the case, is it?
That's right. This is a complicated area. Hopefully, the person has signed a medical directive, which is basically instructions to the medical staff about the life support measures they want or don't want. You know, in my mom's case, she was very specific that she only wanted palliative care. She did not want, you know, invasive surgery. And typically that medical directive is accompanied with a power of attorney, giving someone the power of attorney to act in the patient's stead if they're incapacitated. The person who has that power of attorney before death really has all of the authority. The moment someone dies, that power of attorney also dies and expires, and the person who takes over after that point is the executor. And the executor, more often than not, is appointed by the will. In other words, in your will, you say, my executor will be, you know, my wife, and if my wife cannot serve, then my son, et cetera, et cetera. Becoming an executor is a voluntary act, so you can decline it if you want to, but most people obviously accept it. The book is organized temporarily. In other words, the first chapter is right before death, and then the chapters continue with the hours, days, weeks, months, and years after death. And the reason I structured it that way was because that's when the decisions come up. So we sort of know what the decisions are going to be in that first week, et cetera. So I thought that was helpful. I also purposefully made the book very short and precise. You know, when you're in grief, which is just a terrible state to be in, you really don't have the capacity to be reading a lot of superfluous words. And the index, in every chapter, there's an index at the front and a checklist so that you can scan the chapter quickly to see if in that chapter is where your question is actually answered.
You know, I found going through this process myself, grief is the one thing. It's like you don't know what you're doing in the days after a death. You know, I know in my father's case, when my mother died, he said the first 6 months was just, it was a cloud. He really did not know what was going on for a couple of months. It was like a dream almost. And he really had no business making lots of decisions because he really was not there. And I assume that's a pretty common occurrence.
Oh, it really is. And one of the things that I try to answer in this book are the perennial questions that come up so that people can find those answers as quickly as possible. Let me give you a couple of examples. Well, first of all, let's talk about something sort of before death. And we call it the Thanksgiving conversation. And for those of us who have aging parents, it is so important to sit down while they're still living and over Thanksgiving dinner or at some appropriate time, talk about what they want in terms of a funeral and arrangements, but also talk about where are the documents and let's go collect them. So where is the will? Where's the medical directive? You know, where are the deeds to real property? Where's the title to the car? And hopefully you can collect all those documents and put them in a very safe place so that the survivors have ready access to them. It's a startling fact that 70% or so of the American people do not have written wills. And I'm convinced that it's because most people think that if they write their will on a Tuesday, they're going to be hit by a bus on Wednesday. So we're very afraid to write them. But boy, is it important to do that, especially in today's age where people are living in sort of alternative relationships. You know, if you're not married and you have children, or if you're in a gay relationship, you have a big problem if you haven't documented your intentions, both about who's in control and also who's going to inherit.
And I was interested in your point of being able to find it, because if something happens and a person's in a state in which they can't make their own medical decisions, will a hospital rely on your word that you've been appointed durable power of attorney?
Typically, hospitals ask to see a copy, and it's always good to bring a copy with you. On the other hand, because it is an urgent situation, most people, if you can establish your relationship to the person, that can often suffice. Where the power of attorney becomes most important is where there is disagreement within the family. You might have someone who's on one side wants to do, you know, invasive life-saving surgery, and on the other hand, there's someone who really doesn't think mom wanted that. And in that case, it's great to have that power of attorney because it really defines who does have the authority to make the final decision.
And a lot of times the medical establishment, with no real mind to do so, will opt for the heroic life-saving measures just because of their own Hippocratic oaths and sort of their way of doing business.
Well, yes, and this is really interesting. Both of my parents were doctors. You know, my father used to say all the time that medical malpractice was a horrible thing because it really took away the authority that doctors used to have. And, you know, back in the 40s and 50s, it was often the case that the doctor would know what was going on and would really help accelerate a person's, you know, imminent demise. And today, with all of the risk of liability, doctors will often do what they don't think is in the patient's best interest simply to avoid the risk of liability. It's a terrible state of affairs, but it also emphasizes how important it is to have that medical directive. One of the other key questions you have to answer immediately upon someone's death is whether or not probate is required. And that really is the reason why that decision is important, is you really cannot start distributing assets or paying bills until you've made that decision. And we've all heard the word probate, and we know it's a horrible word. It is a bad word. And one of my last chapter in the book, chapter 6, explains a lot of tricks to get out of probate. But their probate also has a good side, which is the probate is the court-supervised administration of an estate. And what if you go through probate, no creditor can, after the fact, challenge and try to collect against the estate. In many states, there's what's called simplified probate. Oh, by the way, in probate, you almost always have to have an attorney. And the reason we try to avoid probate is because of the cost and the time. Probating estates can last from as short as 3 months to 3 years in major cases. Most states have what's called simplified probate, which is a procedure by which you just file certain forms with the court, which you can do without an attorney. It's the equivalent of probate, but it's just simple. And those are for sort of those middle ground states. And then almost all states have a threshold under which if the estate is worth less than that, you don't have to do probate at all. And in that case, you appoint yourself the executor and you pay off the bills, and then you can distribute the rest of the assets. You know, one of the perennial questions that we answer is, let me give you a hypothetical. Suppose you have a brother, and like many of us, he lived paycheck to paycheck. He never accumulated a lot of worth, and he rents his home. And then when he passes away, he has his furniture and his car and stuff, but very little else. And he owes Visa and MasterCard $50,000. And the question is, do you as the brother or do you as the mother have to pay off his credit card bills? And the answer is emphatically no, with two exceptions, which I'll get to in a minute. And believe me, though, the credit card companies try to convince you that the answer is yes.
Yeah.
And they will hound you after someone passes away. But no one is liable for those debts other than the deceased. And if he didn't have the assets to pay them, you don't have to pay them. There are two key exceptions to that. The first is, in a marital relationship, if the debts were incurred in the marriage, particularly in community property states like California, then the surviving spouse has to pay off those debts because it was the community's obligation. And then the second one is, let me change the fact pattern a little bit. And suppose right before your brother passed away, he won the lottery. And in his checking account at the time of death was $200,000. And you are his heir, so you're going to get the $200,000. In that case, because the assets of the estate are worth more than the debts, you actually have to pay off those debts.
Yeah. And if you take the money, then they can come after you.
Then they can come after you, exactly.
Yeah. My guest today is Scott Smith. He is the author of When Someone Dies, The Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death. He experienced this in his own family, having to negotiate the estate of his mother, made a lot of mistakes, and out of it comes this book to help others avoid some of those mistakes. And one of the first things you say is, if it is not a substantial estate, but even a good-sized estate with a house and there's not a trust set up, you probably need to hire an accountant.
Yes, I recommend almost always hiring an accountant. And then, of course, if you have probate, recommend hiring an attorney as well. But let me tell you why we should hire an accountant, or at least someone who is very familiar with taxes. There can be at least four different types of taxes due when someone passes away. The first is, if someone passes away mid-year and they worked or they had rental properties where they made rental income, that person's going to owe an income tax filing for that period of time during which he or she was alive. And there's also a corollary state income tax filing. In addition, if after someone passes away, the estate exists for long enough that it also makes income, the estate will have an income tax return. And when you become the executor, one of the first questions you have to answer is this estate going to survive for a long enough period of time that it needs to get its own equivalent of a Social Security number? It's called an employer identification number. And if you do, then there's a way to go to the IRS and get an EIN right away. Getting that EIN is very important because that's the only way the estate can open a checking account or open, you know, any sort of financial account. After that, you have to look at the dreaded estate tax or death taxes. Anybody who reads the paper knows that this is a constant raging debate in Congress as to whether there should be an estate tax, and if so, how much should be taxed. Right now, thanks to George Bush, whose policies have been extended, right now the exemption for the estate tax is around $5.3 million, which means if the estate is worth less than $5.3 million, there's no estate tax due. If it's worth more than that, then you have to pay around 35% to 40% on the amount over $5.3 million. And then the fourth type of tax is many states have a similar estate tax, and many of them do not parallel the federal government's minimums. So it's important to check every state in which the deceased passed away to make sure whether or not there's an estate tax due as well.
But as you well know, that $5 million threshold, that's the 1% or half of 1%. Most people are not going to be dealing with estate taxes around the country for the most part, although state can vary from state to state.
Right. And thankfully, most of us, you know, don't have that kind of net worth floating around.
So what are the main steps you need to do? And your book goes through it. Basically, the first day, you basically, again, you're getting death certificates, you're contacting family, you're having to deal with a mortuary of some sort. And you give some very good suggestions on what to do on that, especially if you know the intentions of the deceased. If they wanted to be cremated, there's a lot of different decisions you have to make as opposed to if they have a burial plot or if they've already made arrangements.
That's right. You know, 50 years ago, most families, you know, wanted to be buried in a communal plot. So dad or even granddad had purchased the plot and typically had made funeral arrangements, prepaid, you know, for the funeral. Today, we're a very transient society, and most of us do not have a prepaid arrangement, which means the moment someone passes away, you have to start making the decision as to which mortuary to use. And most mortuaries are very ethical businesses, but they are businesses, and they're in the business of making money. And most mortuaries price their services on a per-item or per-use basis. So every time the body is transported, there's a fee. For every service that's provided, for flowers, there's a fee. In the case of my mom passed away in a hospice setting, but my sister, who's a Buddhist, wanted to leave my mother in state, lying in her bedroom for a day so that her soul could go to heaven, which is a very profound Buddhist tradition. So we moved my mom from the hospice to her home and then after a day to the funeral parlor. And I was just startled to find out that every one of those transits was expensive. You know, the other thing is you are in a state of grief and you're being bombarded with questions. For example, a lot of us who are green choose to have cremation rather than embalming. Putting an embalmed body in the earth is a very toxic gesture to Mother Earth. It's really important to talk before someone passes away about what they want. Do they want to be cremated? What do they want to do in terms of a funeral, a memorial service, etc.? Many times religion comes into play. So if a person was very religious, you can follow the strictures and policies of the religion. But in the absence of that, you really need to sort of figure out what the person wanted. In the case of my mom, she was emphatic. She wanted to be cremated. So when I was working with the funeral parlor, they tried to sell me a coffin for her cremation, and they also tried to sell me a very elaborate, expensive urn to store her ashes in. In both cases, neither of those is required under state law. You know, by law, you do not need a casket for a cremation, and by law, a funeral home is required to provide you the ashes in some usable container, and typically that's a reinforced cardboard box.
Well, that's interesting. You mentioned the paperwork in the days and weeks after death. It's every credit card company. It's contacting if they're collecting Social Security. You have to stop that immediately. And that is one mistake a lot of people do make. I think it's one you made, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, it is. You know, a lot of us today have instant deposits or instant withdrawals from our checking account. In the case of my mom, she had Social Security paying her every month. I never turned Social Security off because I didn't know I needed to. And then finally, when Social Security got wind of her death, they sent me a bill for penalty and interest because I had taken money after my mom's passing. In addition, my mom was a very generous woman, and she had agreed with the American Red Cross and a couple of other charities to donate to them on a monthly basis. And I also forgot to turn those off after she passed away.
And, of course, in an electronic environment, a lot of these records are not easily findable.
They're not easily findable, and most of us are very disorganized. And, again, that goes back to what I said earlier about how important it is to sort of put this information together, both for your parents and also for your children when you might pass away. You mentioned electronic. It's a very important topic these days because people have Facebook pages. They have an online presence as well. And, you know, it used to be very hard to stop that. It's now getting much easier because Facebook and others have recognized what a problem this is. In the case of Facebook, you can contact Facebook, prove your relationship to the deceased, and Facebook will give you access to their pages so that you can memorialize them. And you can do a variety of things to indicate that they have, you know, that someone's passed away. And that actually is an important topic generally, which is people get concerned and confused about who should be notified about a death. And one of the things that I just strongly recommend in this book is that you do the broadest outreach possible. In my mom's case, she had lived in Santa Rosa, California, and then Palo Alto, and prior to that in San Francisco. So she had three relatively recent communities where she had lots of friends. What my three sisters and I did was we divided up her address book and just called everybody. And it was, not only was it very therapeutic for us because we heard so many words of goodwill, but it also, people want to know and people deserve to know. And if people know, they can then contribute and help. They can, you know, water the garden. They can feed the cat, et cetera, et cetera. Similarly, with respect to the obituary, obituaries are not required by law. A probate notice typically is, but that's something very different. And most newspapers charge for obituaries on a per-word basis, so they can become very, very expensive. What I recommend people do is that they write a long-form obituary, which really memorializes the person, brings out all of the qualities and all of the people that they've left behind. You can take that and send it to the alumni association at the college that the person attended. You can send it to any fraternal or religious organizations they belong to. And typically, those organizations will publish the obituary for free to their members. And then you have to just grapple with the question of whether you think the person who passed away wanted an obituary. And if they did, then I recommend you take that very long-form obituary and make it as short as possible and get it in the paper.
Getting back to funerals for a moment, I think there was a section of the book with, you know, you sort of have to come to an accommodation with the rest of the family members if the deceased did not provide their wishes. And sometimes those wishes run counter to the feelings of the loved ones. For example, no services. And I think you had a really interesting suggestion. If the service requirements are sort of outside what the loved ones want, it's all right to have a second service or a memorial if there are no formal services, in which it's almost a time for the loved ones rather than remembering the deceased.
Oh, absolutely. You know, many religions have clear rules about...
Or a formal service, yeah.
A formal service, you know, whether you have an open casket or not, how quickly you bury in many countries, and in the South, in the United States, you know, because of the risks of decomposition, you know, bodies have to be buried within 24, 48 hours. Jewish faith also has a similar type of rule. But if you're, other than complying with that sort of religious requirement, the family should feel very free to do whatever is appropriate under the circumstances for that person. What we did in my mom's case was she had hundreds of friends, and we decided to hold a memorial for her about 4 months after she passed away. And about 350 people attended. It was an absolutely beautiful event. We let people come up, stand up in front of a microphone and sort of talk about mom. And it was just a gorgeous event. And then she had also asked to be cremated and had a very specific spot where she wanted her ashes to be distributed. It was the top of a hillside that she and her husband used to walk to all the time. So about a week after the memorial service, my sisters and my stepsister and brother, we all congregated and took Mom's ashes up there and distributed her in the hillside.
The last section of the book, from your own experiences, after you go through this process, you start thinking about, well, how can I make it easier for my survivors? And you have a whole step list of things that you should do. What are the top of the step list?
Oh, that's such a good question. Thanks. Most important is if you have any sort of substantive assets, and particularly if you're married, put all of your assets in a trust. Mm-hmm. Every estate lawyer knows how to do this. They're called AB trusts. They're called living trusts. They're very easy to do. They're very easy to accomplish. And the benefit of a trust is, number one, all of the assets in a trust do not go through probate. So you take probate typically off the table, no matter what the size of the estate. And secondly, you can do significant tax planning because you can move some of the assets into the marital exemption and some of the other assets into the overall exemption, and thereby increase the basis in property and in many cases avoid paying taxes on any of the gain for a very long period of time.
And for the survivors themselves, it's helpful to get everything together and sort of notify people where this stuff is, because that's one of the biggest problems is knowing where, you know, if you have mutual funds here, you've got, you know, if you're a member of a union, usually there's a little beneficiary at the end of your life, or you're a veteran, you got to know all, and you have to know all this stuff.
Oh, absolutely. And if you've got life insurance, put the life insurance policy there, let people know, you know, get all of your paperwork put together in one place and let a lot of people know where it is. You know, it's interesting, one of the things about life insurance, one of the earlier chapters in the book, one of the things that I address is getting quick access to cash. And in the last part of the book, we talk about ways to make sure that when you die, someone can get access to your cash. You know, the moment someone passes away, all of these expenses start adding up. You have to pay the funeral home. You have to pay the kennel for storing the dog. You have to pay a gardener to take care of the house. And you really need to look very quickly to find if you can access the deceased's checking account. So, for example, I recommend having someone else be a co-signer on the checking account. So husband and wife or father, son, whatever, so that you can continue to access a person's cash after they pass away. Also looking at credit cards that may have available balances so that you can access that. One of the things about life insurance that's so important is life insurance, up until the time someone passes away, is owned by the insured. But the moment someone passes away, it's owned by the beneficiary. Life insurance proceeds where there's a designated beneficiary not only don't go through probate, but they aren't considered part of the estate. So you can get immediate access to that cash. That's just one example.
Well, the name of the book is When Someone Dies, The Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death. Scott, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Scott Taylor Smith is the author of When Someone Dies, The Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death. It's published by Scribner. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.